A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been engraving inventory as they move the apartment, and it's made him realize something. You look at a piece of metal in an electronics enclosure or a component, and you don't actually know what you're dealing with. And if you're about to engrave it or drill into it, that question stops being academic and starts being about what you're about to breathe in.
The moment where the bit hits and the feel is wrong, that's the moment. You've been cruising through aluminum, and suddenly the resistance changes, the sound changes, and your brain goes, wait, what is this?
You're already committed. The bit's in. There's dust in the air. You're standing there wondering if you should stop or just push through.
That split-second decision is exactly what Daniel's getting at. More people are engraving at home now, marking tools, labeling equipment, doing light fabrication. The barrier to entry for machining has basically collapsed. You can buy a capable rotary tool for under $100 and start removing material from things you haven't identified. Here's the thing, you can't always trust your eyes. Anodized aluminum doesn't look like bare aluminum. Under certain lighting, both can pass for stainless steel. I've picked up a part, been absolutely certain it was steel, and then the file just glides through it like butter.
The classic, I've been betrayed by a finish moment.
So the core problem Daniel's pointing at is, visual identification is unreliable. And the consequences of getting it wrong aren't just about ruining the part. They're about what ends up in your lungs.
You're not just dealing with one question. You're dealing with three at once. What's the base metal? What's on the surface? And where does this thing actually live? What's its job?
That's the framework. Physical properties, surface finishes, and context. And the reason all three matter is that they cross-check each other. A magnet tells you one thing, but the weight in your hand tells you another, and the fact that the part came out of an RF connector housing tells you something else entirely.
We're building a decision tree, not a single test.
And the decision tree has a very specific endpoint. Do I need to be worried about what I'm about to aerosolize? Because metal dust isn't one category of hazard. You've got nuisance dusts, aluminum, iron, where the concern is chronic accumulation over years. Then you've got irritants like copper and zinc. Then you jump to sensitizers, beryllium, hexavalent chromium, where a single exposure can trigger an immune response that never goes away. And then systemic toxins like cadmium and lead.
The question is, this aluminum or steel is really the first step in a risk assessment?
That's what I think Daniel's really asking. Not teach me metallurgy, but give me a workflow so I know when I can relax and when I need to stop and suit up.
Which is a surprisingly practical thing that almost nobody teaches hobbyists. You buy the rotary tool, you watch a few YouTube videos about technique, and nobody mentions that the shiny gold connector you're about to drill through might be cadmium plated.
Or that the non-magnetic spring contact that looks like brass is actually beryllium copper, and the OSHA exposure limit for beryllium dust is 0.2 micrograms per cubic meter. That's not a typo, micrograms.
The goal here is, by the end of this, you can pick up an unknown piece of metal, run through a few tests with tools you probably already own, and make an informed decision about whether you're comfortable putting a bit into it.
If the answer is, I still don't know, we'll cover the protocol for that too. Because sometimes the right move is treating it like the worst case. Let's start with a test that takes 2 seconds and a fridge magnet. You hold it up to the part. If it sticks, you're almost certainly dealing with carbon steel or a ferritic stainless like 430. If it doesn't stick, you've narrowed the field, but you haven't narrowed it to safety.
This is the part where the magnet test gets people into trouble.
Because non-magnetic doesn't mean aluminum. Most stainless steels, 304, 3016, are non-magnetic in their annealed state, so you could be holding stainless and think you've got aluminum. And beryllium copper, which we need to talk about, is also non-magnetic. Visually, it's a dead ringer for brass.
The magnet is your first filter, not your final answer.
Next thing I do is the weight check. Aluminum is 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter. Steel is 7.8. That's nearly a factor of 3 difference. You can feel it instantly if you've got a known piece of aluminum in one hand and the mystery part in the other. Aluminum feels almost dead in the hand. There's a hollowness to it. Steel has heft.
The balance test, same size piece in each hand, is surprisingly reliable for rough sorting.
It really is. Your hands are better at comparative density than people give them credit for. If the part is small, like a connector or a standoff, the weight difference can be subtle. But for anything enclosure-sized, a drive caddy, a chassis panel, it's night and day. Now, if you're still unsure after weight, the scratch test is next. Aluminum is soft. A steel file bites into it immediately and leaves a bright silvery streak. Stainless steel resists. The file skates a little and the scratch is duller.
If you're planning to grind it anyway, the spark test is definitive.
Carbon steel throws bright yellow sparks that fork and burst like little fireworks. Stainless steel sparks are duller, more orange, and there are fewer of them. Aluminum produces no sparks at all. That's a 1 second test that tells you everything, but you're already generating dust by that point, so you want to have your PPE on before you touch the wheel.
Before you even get to grinding, there's another layer of information sitting right on the surface.
This is where anodizing throws people. Anodized aluminum has a ceramic-like feel. It's harder than the base metal, it's non-conductive, and a file won't bite as easily. You can test this with a multimeter. Bare aluminum conducts. Anodized aluminum doesn't. The oxide layer is an insulator.
There's more than one kind.
Type 2 anodizing, the sulfuric acid process, is what you see on most electronics enclosures. It's 5 to 25 microns thick, usually clear or dyed. Type 3, hard coat, is 25 to 150 microns, noticeably darker and much harder. If you scratch type 3, you'll feel the resistance. If you scratch bare aluminum, it practically gives way.
Then there's the plated stuff, which is usually steel wearing a costume.
Zinc plating has that yellow-green iridescence, very common on hardware store bolts and brackets. Nickel plating is brighter, whiter, more corrosion resistant. Chrome is the mirror finish, extremely hard, very reflective. And here's why the finish matters for safety. If you're grinding zinc-plated steel, you're aerosolizing zinc, and that's the metal fume fever pathway. Nickel and chrome each have their own toxicity profiles.
The finish isn't just cosmetic. It's part of the hazard assessment.
Which brings us to the metal that keeps safety officers up at night, found in RF connectors, microwave components, spring contacts. Anywhere you need, conductivity plus springiness. It looks like brass. It's non-magnetic. And if you machine it, the dust can trigger chronic beryllium disease in sensitized individuals. OSHA's exposure limit is 0.2 micrograms per cubic meter. For context, that's roughly 1/500th the limit for aluminum dust.
You'd never know you were looking at it.
You wouldn't. A server rack chassis is probably 5-year-5-2 aluminum with clear type 2 anodize. A hard drive caddy is probably nickel-plated steel, but that gold-colored contact inside the RF connector could be beryllium copper, could be phosphor bronze. You can't tell by looking, and the magnet won't help you.
The identification workflow has to account for the stuff you can't identify.
That's exactly where we're headed next. Because once you know what you might be dealing with, the question shifts from, what is this metal, to what am I willing to do to it, and how do I protect myself while I'm doing it? Let's build the hazard ladder because not all metal dust is created equal. At the bottom, you've got nuisance dusts. Aluminum, iron, OSHA literally classifies aluminum as a nuisance particulate. That sounds reassuring until you read the occupational studies showing chronic exposure linked to pulmonary fibrosis. It's a regulatory term, not a medical one. It means the stuff doesn't cause acute toxicity or cancer. But it accumulates. Year after year of inhaling fine aluminum dust, and your lungs don't clear it. There was a NIOSH study a couple years ago, hobbyist machining of aluminum in a typical garage workshop, no ventilation, and respirable particles exceeded OSHA limits within 15 minutes.
15 minutes is not a long engraving session.
It's one afternoon of marking inventory. So, nuisance doesn't mean harmless, it means the damage is slow.
Then you climb the ladder.
Next rung is irritant dusts, copper, zinc. These cause immediate inflammation in the airways. But zinc has a specific trick that catches people off guard, metal fume fever. You're welding or grinding galvanized steel, you inhale zinc oxide fumes, and 4 to 12 hours later you've got chills, fever, muscle aches. Feels exactly like the flu. It resolves in a day or two, but repeated exposure can flip your immune system into hypersensitivity.
This is from grinding the coating, not the base metal.
Right. Galvanized steel is just steel with a zinc layer. The steel underneath is fine. But that yellow-green plating you're grinding off is what put you in bed that night. Engraving doesn't usually generate enough heat to vaporize zinc, but drilling can, and grinding definitely does.
The finish identification we talked about in part one isn't just academic. If you see that yellow-green iridescence, you know to treat the dust differently.
Now the next rung is where things get serious. Sensitizers. Beryllium, hexavalent chromium. These trigger an immune response in some people that never shuts off. Chronic beryllium disease is the textbook example. Even a single brief exposure to beryllium dust can sensitize you, and from that point forward, your immune system attacks your lungs every time it encounters beryllium.
There's no safe threshold.
OSHA's permissible exposure limit is 0.2 micrograms per cubic meter. That's not a number most people can visualize, so here's the comparison. The aluminum limit is roughly 500 times higher. Beryllium is regulated at the detection threshold because below that we can't reliably measure it, not because we know it's safe. The Department of Energy requires beryllium testing on any scrap metal leaving nuclear facilities before disposal. That's the level of caution we're talking about.
This turns up in electronics.
RF connectors, microwave components, some aerospace parts that find their way into surplus. Spring contacts where you need conductivity plus mechanical resilience. It looks like brass, it's non-magnetic, and you will not know you've machined it until potentially years later when the granulomas show up on a chest x-ray.
Which is a terrifying sentence.
It should be. And then the top rung, systemic toxins. Cadmium plating was used for decades on fasteners and hardware for corrosion resistance. It's that distinctive bright yellow or gold finish. Cadmium dust is a group 1 carcinogen, known human carcinogen, no ambiguity, and it accumulates in your kidneys. You don't clear it. Once it's in, it stays.
The hierarchy is nuisance, irritant, sensitizer, systemic toxin, and the PPE you need depends on where your metal sits on that ladder.
Here's the problem. Daniel's question forces us to confront. You often don't know. So we need to flip the framework. Instead of identify the metal, then choose protection, you start with the task and work backward. For engraving, low material removal, low heat. A P100 respirator and good cross ventilation is usually sufficient, provided you've ruled out beryllium and cadmium.
If you haven't ruled them out,
that's the unknown metal protocol. If you can't positively identify the base metal, the finish, or the part's origin, any one of those three, you treat it as the worst case. HEPA filter vacuum at the point of contact, P100 respirator, and avoid dry anything. Wet methods reduce airborne dust by orders of magnitude. A few drops of water or cutting oil at the engraving point, and the particles never become respirable.
The decision tree Daniel needs is, can I identify this? If yes, match PPE to the hazard level. If no, maximum controls.
For drilling, you step up. Add local exhaust if you can, definitely the HEPA vacuum. For grinding, it's full face shield, local exhaust ventilation, P100 minimum. The hierarchy of controls says engineering controls. Capturing dust at the source. Always be personal protective equipment. A respirator is the last line, not the first.
Which is the thing almost nobody tells you when you buy the rotary tool?
The manual says wear eye protection. It doesn't say if you can't identify the metal, assume it contains cadmium and act accordingly. Let's turn all of this into something you can actually use. I want to give Daniel, and anyone else holding an engraver over a mystery part, a repeatable workflow, 5 steps, tools you probably already own.
Decision tree on a post-it note. I like it.
Step 1, magnet. Takes 2 seconds. If it sticks, you're in carbon steel or 430 stainless territory. If it doesn't, you've ruled those out, but you've ruled nothing in. Step 2, weight. Same size reference piece in each hand. Aluminum in one, mystery, part in the other. The density difference is almost a factor of 3. You'll feel it.
If you don't have a reference piece, that's step 0. Get one. We'll come back to that.
Step 3, scratch test. A steel file on aluminum bites immediately, bright silvery streak. On stainless, it skates, duller mark. On anodized aluminum, it resists. That ceramic oxide layer is harder than the base metal. Step 4, multimeter. Touch the probes to the surface. Bare aluminum conducts, anodized doesn't. This is the fastest way to confirm you're looking at an anodized finish and not something plated.
If you're still unsure after all 4?
Step 5 is the spark test, but only if you're already planning to grind. And only after you've got your PPE on. Carbon steel throws bright yellow forking sparks, stainless throws dull orange, aluminum throws nothing. That's your definitive answer, but you're generating dust to get it, so it's the last test, not the first.
The whole time you're documenting. Sharpie on a piece of tape, stick it to the part. Magnet yes or no, weight heavy or light, scratch easy or hard, conductivity yes or no. Next time you pick up that part, you're not starting from zero.
Which brings us to the reference kit. This is the single highest return thing you can do this weekend. Go to a hardware store or a metal supplier, get small offcuts of aluminum, 6006-1, 3004 stainless, brass, copper, and plain carbon steel. Label each one. Now you've got comparison standards. When you pick up a mystery part, you're not guessing weight from memory. You're doing an A-B test against a known sample.
It's like keeping a color swatch for paint matching. Your hands are good at comparison and terrible at absolute measurement.
And the kit costs maybe $20. Now for the PPE side, let's make this specific by task because be careful isn't actionable. Engraving, low material removal, P100 respirator plus cross ventilation. Open a window, put a fan behind you blowing across the work surface. That's your minimum. Drilling, add local exhaust if you can. A HEPA-filtered shop vac nozzle positioned right at the drill point. Grinding, full face shield, local exhaust ventilation, P100 respirator, and never dry if you can avoid it.
The unknown metal protocol overrides all of that.
The three unknowns rule. If you can't identify the base metal, or you can't identify the finish, or you don't know where the part came from, any one of those three, you assume it contains a hazardous element and you use maximum controls. HEPA vacuum at the point of contact, P100, wet methods, full containment. It's a hassle, absolutely. But the alternative is discovering 5 years from now that the gold-colored connector you engraved one afternoon was cadmium-plated.
Cadmium doesn't leave.
It doesn't. So the workflow Daniel walks away with is, identify if you can, document what you find, match your PPE to the task and the hazard level, and when in doubt, treat it like the worst case. Overprotection costs you 10 minutes of setup. Underprotection can cost you lung function you don't get back.
That's the kind of trade-off that makes the decision easy, once you actually know the stakes.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The oldest recorded seaweed harvesting tradition belongs to the coastal communities of the Caspian Sea, where fishermen in present-day Turkmenistan used woven reed baskets to gather bladderwrack for cattle fodder, a practice documented in a 1512 travelogue by a Venetian merchant who noted the harvesters worked only during the new moon. Believing the seaweed was less slippery then.
Less slippery seaweed is a niche concern. It's wild to think about, though, how much the tool access has outpaced the safety knowledge. You can get a benchtop mill for under $1,000 now. A decade ago, there was a five-figure machine, and you probably took a class before you touched it.
The barrier to entry collapsed, and the education didn't follow. YouTube will teach you feeds and speeds in 20 minutes, but nobody's doing a video on here's how to check if your mystery metal contains cadmium before you turn it into breathable dust.
It's not like the information doesn't exist. It's just locked inside industrial hygiene manuals and OSHA technical documents that nobody reads for fun.
Which is the gap Daniel's question really exposes. The knowledge exists, the tools are in people's hands, and the bridge between them is basically missing. I don't know how you solve that at scale. Regulation's too slow. YouTube incentives reward flashy projects over safety deep dives.
There might be a hardware solution coming, though. I've been watching what's happening with handheld XRF analyzers. Those are the guns scrapyards use to identify alloys in seconds. Point it at a piece of metal. It tells you the elemental composition. Historically, they've been $15,000 to $30,000.
Right, completely out of reach for a hobbyist. But the sensor technology is getting cheaper. There are benchtop units now in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, and some startups are claiming they can hit $500 within 5 years by using lower resolution detectors paired with machine learning to fill in the gaps.
A $500 XRF gun that lives in your toolbox next to the multimeter. That changes the whole equation.
You zap the part, the screen says beryllium copper or cadmium plated, and you know exactly what you're dealing with before the bit ever touches metal. That's the dream. Identification replaces assumption.
Until that exists, we're back to the workflow. Magnet, weight, scratch, multimeter, spark. When in doubt, maximum controls.
If you've got your own tricks for identifying mystery metals, or a close call you want to share so someone else avoids it, we want to hear about it. Drop us a note at myweirdprompts.com. We might do a follow-up episode on listener stories.
The home shop isn't getting less sophisticated. The tools are only going to get better. The question is whether the safety culture catches up, and that's partly on us, the people who've already figured out what can go wrong, to make sure the next person doesn't have to learn it the hard way.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the question that probably saved someone's lungs.
We'll be back next week. Until then, identify before you engrave.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.